This podcast contains topics related to crime, death, and domestic violence and may contain strong language. Listener discretion is advised. On a hot and humid August day in 1987, police were dispatched to a two-bedroom apartment in North Philadelphia. The tenant of 4 years had been evicted that day due to an intolerable smell wafting from his residence. Before leaving, the tenant nailed a room shut and told the landlord, Nathaniel Choice, that he'd return later to retrieve his belongings. When Nathaniel sent his son and nephew to begin to clean the apartment, they were unable to get in. When they peeked through the keyhole, they knew the next move would be to call the police. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Brian.
And this is The City of Brotherly Blood, Episode 2. Today we're getting a glimpse of the Philly crime scene in the 1980s. Many of you know that it was Gary Heidnik and his basement chamber of women dominating the news circuits at this particular time, perhaps overshadowing a man equally as disturbed and with a similar love of using his home as the setting for his activities. That man was Harrison, known to most as Marty Graham. And what I found really interesting is that so many of the newspaper stories about Marty Graham mention Gary Heidnik, who in his own right was a criminal muse. Did you know that the character of Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs was based on Gary Heidnik?
No, really?
It was.
You didn't tell me that before we started this?
Yes.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, it was, you know, the whole put the lotion in the basket or else it gets the hose again. And Brian knows I love to say that line.
She does. She says it all the time. And, you know, full disclosure, we've DVR'd The Silence of the Lambs, but I've never seen it.
Yes, that's a shameful.
We DVR'd it. We're waiting to watch it together, but you use that quote all the time.
That's not how I discipline the children. I just want to let you know that. And though there was plenty of news coverage on Gary Heidnik, I could not locate one blessed interview or newscast about Marty Graham. In fact, as recent as last year, I actually saw that they were recognizing the 30th anniversary of Gary Heidnik's crimes and interviewing the people who survived it. People like criminal justice professor Anthony Walsh think that's symptomatic of a, quote, broader unawareness or neglect of Black serial killers in America. Now, I'm honestly not sure what to make of that statement. I do agree that we rarely hear of people of color who are serial killers. At the same time, I don't know that neglect is the right word. Maybe poorly studied is more fitting. The bottom line is giving too much attention to any serial killer can be seen as glamorizing horrific behavior and exploiting the victims. But we do hope in some small way to honor those people who are victims of these unspeakable crimes.
That's absolutely right. So getting back to what was going on at Marty's apartment, though, what greeted police when they knocked down Marty's door were waist-high piles of trash not suitable for work drawings and swear words scrawled on the walls. There was also an undeniable smell of death. They found in various stages of decay the bodies of 6 women. In one bedroom lie 2 women, both bloated and discolored, one nude. Amongst more filth, roaches and fleas, syringes and spoons, jars filled with unknown fluids, another woman was discovered wrapped in blankets and buried under rags and debris. Hours later, police uncovered a 4th set of mummified remains, also wrapped in sheets and buried in a trash grave. The 5th body was found sandwiched between 2 mattresses, causing searchers to wonder if she was slept upon post-mortem. The 6th and final body was located shoved in a 6-inch closet, wrapped in a sheet bound by an electrical cord. And I gotta ask, like, who has a 6-inch closet? And, I mean, to put a human being in 6 inches.
It's deliberate.
Absolutely. That's a great word.
Right.
It's disturbing and deliberate.
It's true. Now, by this time, a curious crowd had gathered around the apartment building that was now sealed off with crime scene tape. The people watched as empty body bags entered the residence and full ones exited. The next day, the search extended outside of the House of Horrors, and it was not in vain. On the roof of Marty's apartment, police found a canvas bag containing the leg and foot bones of a seventh body. It was no secret who had occupied this minefield of corpses on North 19th Street. The police promptly circulated Marty's photo citywide and began making their rounds to ask questions. And those who knew him did not spare any details.
Harrison Graham was born on October 9, 1958, the eldest of five children. Though there's not a plethora of information about his upbringing, we know from Marty's mom, Lillian, that Harrison's childhood was far from idyllic. Lillian alleged that at age 12, he was diagnosed with a mental disorder and hospitalized for 2 years.
Now, the fact that we don't know what the mental disorder was, I think really speaks heavily to the fact that mental illness was not something that was widely recognized at the time, or it wasn't really specified either. So his own mother that cared for him was under, you know, her roof, had no idea what the actual mental illness was, just that he needed to be hospitalized for it.
Yeah, and I don't think that was a stretch for that time period.
No.
He was also noted to have learning disabilities and spent some time in a foster home. Lillian, who herself was a young mother, giving birth to her firstborn when she was just 16 and soon to be followed by four others, was likely overwhelmed with caring for a child with special needs. Eventually, Marty found his way back into his mother's home after being in the foster home for that time and remained there for many years. But like many others who live in a neighborhood that offers quick access to drugs, he fell into a long cycle of addiction. This is especially unsurprising in Marty's case because there is a wealth of studies from the National Institute on Drug Abuse that show that about half of those living with mental illness during their lives will also experience a substance use disorder and vice versa.
Yeah, normally it would be a what came first, the chicken or the egg scenario, but we know from Lillian that Marty's mental health woes were recognized in pre-adolescence, well before his drug use began. So Lillian, unable to peacefully coexist with Marty's drug habit, finally asked him to leave her home, though she remained in contact with her son. A high school dropout, Marty made his way by doing handyman work in his neighborhood in North Philly, and was largely known to be pleasant, albeit peculiar person. As odd jobs did not quite pay the rent, Marty also took to dealing drugs. He offered cheap highs and provided, in his own home, something of a safe injection site, minus the safety. An anonymous informant told police that someone could get any number of drugs at Marty's place, and they cited R&Ts among others. I had no clue what R&Ts were until I did research on this. So apparently R&Ts are Ritalin and Tylenol. So Ritalin's a stimulant, and Tylenol is a painkiller, and together apparently they offer a really quick high. And the only pay Marty received on the books was $300 a month of Social Security disability. It has never been disclosed what exactly his disability was, but we can place a confident bet that it was a mental health condition.
An acquaintance reported that Marty would sometimes tote around a composition notebook filled with crude sketches of dismembered body parts, including breasts, feet, and male genitalia.
Yeah, I think this, for some strange reason, reminded me of the movie Superbad, where Jonah Hill has an issue when he's a child of sketching pictures of dicks.
I totally forgot about that.
Yeah. And Michael Cera is like, that is so weird.
Oh, God. So anyway, the same acquaintance that was talking about his book of dicks spoke of a time when Marty dangled a woman named Renee out of his third story window, only pulling her back in after a long screaming session. What?
Yeah.
Marty was not short on female companionship and frequently had women coming and going from his place. Two even took to living with him at different periods. The women Marty was involved with were all known to have substance abuse issues, and that didn't mean family and friends were unconcerned with their whereabouts. After seeing TV coverage of the House of Horrors, a woman rushed to the scene because a friend of hers who had lived in Marty's building was missing for several months. That woman was Sandra Garvin, and her friend was sure she was among the dead.
Another woman, Mary Jeter Mathis, a mother of five who lived with her children and mother across the city from Graham's apartment, had been missing for only a few days. Her husband, Doug, who she was recently separated from, said he had last seen her on August 5th. Hers was the only body that was easily identified through fingerprints and a distinctive t-shirt with a rose that she wore often. I really have to admit here that the discovery of Mary in particular hit me pretty hard, because not only did she leave several children behind, but I looked at her obituary and we just see this really lovely young woman in her cap and gown. She has a proud smile on her face, and being able to identify that life and put a face to a name does something to humanize exactly what was lost in this situation. And among all of Marty's less than kosher dealings, he did have time to make his rounds in the neighborhood.
Right. Marty was known to take long walks and play basketball with the neighborhood kids. He was popular among the younger children for doing a spot-on Cookie Monster impression.
Do it, Bri.
Cookie, cookie, cookie.
Yeah, we call Brian the Cookie Monster, too. It's for less sinister reasons, though. We can't keep a bag of double-stuffed Oreos anywhere anymore.
Hey, now. I mean, okay. But Marty's love of the character was not just limited to eating a bag of cookies and speaking like the beloved Sesame Street icon. He also always had his ratty Cookie Monster puppet in tow, and he slept with it too.
Right. We know this definitively because when the police seized the toy as evidence, he said, "I sleep with that." So I don't think there could be any
really,
more.
Yeah.
There's not a shadow of a doubt.
Can't argue with that one. He was also known for some strange behaviors like getting drunk and dancing in the street and digging shallow graves for his dogs. The grave thing would sound suspicious, but we know Marty had dogs from the molded dog feces scattered around his apartment.
Yeah. It was a scene out of Hoarders, the homicide edition of Hoarders.
Yeah. Animal cruelty, sticking people in 6-inch closets.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So in the midst of the search for Marty, many tips had come in placing him, who had a newly grown beard to throw off curious eyes, at random locations like a gas station and homeless shelter. But by the time police arrived, Marty had already moved on. Marty knew the Philly PD were at his back, and his family believed wholeheartedly that he was not responsible for the deaths directly. So they put an appeal for him to turn himself in to police. Following the advice, the 29-year-old, accompanied by his mom Lillian, turned himself in a week later and was arrested without incident. Marty was only initially to be charged with 7 counts of abuse of a corpse, because the DA's office rejected the police request to issue a warrant for murder until more information came from the medical examiner's office. Knowing that Marty's place was a drug haven, it was a good possibility that the women had simply overdosed and were left where they lay or shoved aside, squalor accumulating around them like a dumping ground. It was difficult for the medical examiner to determine causes of death due to the hasty decomposition of many of the women's remains in the summer heat. But 3 were decidedly strangulation.
Yeah, but Marty maintained innocence in a very interesting way. He actually claimed that the bodies were there when he moved in, and he feared telling anyone.
Right, he inherited that problem.
It was just like a leaky faucet.
It came on the deed. When he signed the lease.
Bad home inspection.
Corpses were on the lease.
Yeah, they were there.
If they were found in any type of altered state, he would not get his security deposit back.
Oh, man. Well, after an arduous interrogation, Marty finally confessed to killing all 7 women by strangling them. Although he was hazy on the exact details, he did recall providing drugs to some of the women, choking them during consensual sex, and waking up next to them, and they were dead. He was always surprised.
Yeah, he woke up and he was like, what?
Right, every time.
Every time.
And the others, you know, he only remembered some, you know, what happened to a few of those women. The others, he just, you know, assumed might have been strangled during drug-riddled tirades.
So the victims were ultimately identified as the following women: Cynthia Brooks, age 27, Mary Jeter Mathis, age 36, Barbara Mahoney, age 22, Robin DeShazer, age 29, Sandra Garvin, age 33, and Patricia Franklin, age 24. The seventh victim, of whom they only had the skeletal remains, was assigned to a forensic sculptor, Frank Bender, who with his own hands constructed a face from clay around the skull and actually developed a close enough likeness to get a positive ID from the family. And it was Valerie Jameson, age 25, mother of two, who had gone missing in April 1986. Did you even know that a forensic sculptor was a job you could have?
I didn't, but it definitely sounds like something from CSI.
It really does.
It sounds awesome.
It's very impressive.
Yeah. I mean, that's incredible, to be honest with you. I mean, we've learned so much doing these podcasts. I mean, just that alone, what was the other one, the R&T?
R&T.
The R&T, you know?
When I need to have a pocket guide of street drugs.
We used to do...
readily available.
We used to just do R&R.
That's the much more innocent version.
In the pre-trial hearings, with an inkling that Marty had mental illness at work, he was evaluated several times for his ability to stand trial. The results were all over the board, with Marty being evasive, low-functioning, and claiming not to know why he was there, to him being articulate and cooperative. Ultimately, they determined that, despite showing evidence of personality disorders, he understood enough to proceed. A couple experts felt he may have been leaning too hard on a multiple personality presentation, but ended up being clearer-headed after a regular regimen of antipsychotic meds. When trial time came, Graham opted for a bench trial, understanding that the graphic evidence may take away favor with the jury. So it was up to a common pleas judge, Robert Latrone, alone to hear the evidence and witness testimony and determine Marty's fate. A witness for the defense, Pauline Williams, his foster mom of 5 years, claimed, and I quote here, "Marty is a child in a man's body. Marty is retarded." His counsel claimed psychosis and multiple personality disorder. Still, it was ultimately the strong, grisly evidence and the accounts of two women who said that not only did Marty attack them, but he also claimed to have killed other women that sealed his guilty verdict.
Right, and even the people that evaluated Marty said that he had some signals to basically say he probably does have a dissociative personality disorder or a multiple personality disorder. And to me, I think that that makes him less reliable as a witness or as somebody who accounts for what happened. But then you also have to wonder, at times that he was lucid and he saw these dead bodies around, why wouldn't he have said something then?
Right. Again, going back to, I just woke up and they were there. Right. So I just hid them.
Exactly.
Or they were already, you know, in my apartment when I moved in.
Right. So that's why the experts were saying he's maybe leaning too far into the whole multiple personality thing, maybe to get himself off of being convicted of the crime. But when it came time for sentencing, Marty's mom tearfully pleaded with a judge to spare his life. On the other end of the fence, the mother of victim Barbara Mahoney assertively stated, "I believe he should die. I believe he should have a hard death. Nothing can bring my daughter back, and I am angry about that. But I would be angrier yet if he just sits in jail and gets fatter and fatter."
Judge Latrone again presented Marty with the option of having a jury of 12 determine his sentence, which he again waived. In a strange sentencing delivery in May 1988, Latrone handed over six consecutive sentences of 7 to 14 years, six death sentences, and one life term. But here was the condition. Graham was not to be put to death until he served his life term. This essentially was a long-winded way of giving life without the possibility of parole. Now, immediately following sentencing, Marty asked for his Cookie Monster back. Judge Latrone said, "That was a no-go, but he was allowed to have a couple finger puppets. I mean, it's so parental. He was like, you cannot have your Cookie Monster, but you can have three finger puppets. Go to your room.
I get to decide which finger puppets you get.
I mean, that's...
Oscar might have been fitting.
Oh, man.
Graham actually took his imprisonment in stride, and he took up religious studies. He was actually ordained a minister. So he was walking around the jailhouse, being referred to as Pastor Marty, probably.
Wow.
Yeah. And it wasn't until 1994 that a law clerk was doing a routine review of the case and determined the sentence to be illegal. In a unanimous vote, the Supreme Court said the death sentence must be carried out.
Wow.
So
wait, I've literally never heard of anything like that.
Right. He was doing a review to see what the outcome was, and I guess he realized the way that Judge Latrone delivered the sentencing was completely unconstitutional.
Do you think Judge Latrone was, like, trying to be lenient on Marty because of his mental condition?
I think that that's what it was. I think that there was so much uncertainty there, and the onus was completely on Judge Latrone to decide his fate.
Oh, because, again, it wasn't a bench
trial. Right, he waived
it. It was a bench trial.
Okay. And he waived his right to have the jury decide. And I think that Judge Latrone was like, he may or may not have very untreatable or untreated mental illness. And this is the way I think I can get around sparing his life, but keeping him behind bars forever.
Wow.
Right. But to spare you the legalese and court gymnastics of what ensued thereafter, Graham's death sentence was ultimately vacated in 2003 because of his low IQ and the onset of mental illness before he turned 18. The life sentence was what remained. In 2006, Dr. Alan Branson interviewed Marty at the state correctional facility in Cole Township and quickly concluded that despite attempts to argue Marty was mentally retarded, he was just drug-addled during that time in his life. In the end, I think it's unfair to blame the crimes on drug use alone. It's clear that Marty suffered from mental illness coupled with his addiction, and he had no access to rehab or mental health services. Or he just simply neglected to seek them. The Cookie Monster doll alone shows a very childlike component to his mental state, but at the same time, he seems to be thriving now in the prison environment. Could this be because he's now properly medicated and free of drugs? Likely so. I just think that this speaks to, again, how mental health was so underappreciated as something that needed to be aggressively treated back in the 1980s, especially him being raised in a poor community that didn't have a whole lot of healthcare services in general, and the understanding of mental illness was so low.
You're absolutely right, but it is also important to remember, you know, how far we've come since that time and how society as a whole views, you know, mental health. It's definitely become a much more hot topic, you know, something that is
more widely recognized.
Absolutely.
I do think that we have a little bit of a firmer grasp on mental health in more recent years. Still, though, there's so much neglect for using mental illness as the reason why people do terrible things.
Exactly, and that's so important to remember. I mean, no matter what Marty's mental state was, he's a murderer.
He is a murderer. But again, it just goes back to wondering if he had been properly medicated, would he have done the things that he had done? I don't know. And in that same breath, looking at the women that Marty had killed, you have to wonder whether their state of addiction had clouded their judgment and even associating with Marty. So it was kind of the perfect storm of events. Marty was an addict and he had mental illness, and these women were also addicts. So they were operating in almost this altered state of reality where the women probably didn't see the dangers, and possibly Marty had no idea what he was doing in either his high haze or his mental illness. With that being said, that is it for our case on Marty Graham, the Cookie Monster. Please please join us next time for episode 3, where we're skating you out to the suburbs of Philadelphia. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Brian.
And this is the City of Brotherly Blood.
Have a good one.